Hello and welcome to Halfwit History. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Kylie.
And this is a show where we talk about the upcoming week, but a long time ago.
And sometimes not so long ago.
What kind of long or not so long ago are we doing today?
This week, we are taking a look at a shining star of ages past. And no, I'm not talking about the outer space type of star.
No, why not?
I know. Well, because I'm talking about a superstar. An actor. As the player says in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, we're actors. We're the opposite of people. And the actor that I'm going to be talking about today was called Ethel Barrymore, dubbed the First Lady of the American Theater, and she was born on August 15th, 1879.
And that's our date.
And that is our date, yes.
Now, you may notice that August 15th that looks nothing like a date in September.
Uh-huh.
So we got the opportunity to go to Japan for a good amount of time. We were there for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then it took a while to get back on our feet afterwards. So
I'm still taking naps, so.
Yeah. So we are releasing this one, even though it's not technically the upcoming week. What we were supposed to record over the vacation that we took. And then the other update related to that is we are going to put out an episode. Our next episode is going to be about our trip to Japan.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to listen to that. And we're going to basically like talk about the things that we did and then find like a few of those things and talk a little bit more about them from like a historical sense and just kind of give you guys a picture of all the things we did and learned and the fun we had.
Yeah.
And then one more little update before we jump back into our real topic here is that we are going to be taking a little bit of a break. Kylie has just started up school again and they've messed up what her schedule is and she needs to make brand new lesson plans again. So
I'm having a fun time. It's great.
We need to take
a
little bit of a break. She's going to start working on episodes from December backwards. Yep. So you'll at least hear us then. And at some point, we're going to figure out something else that we can do so that we can remain a little bit more consistent. We got better.
And then we failed again. I don't know what
happened. No, we didn't fail again. It's we were doing well working backwards. And then life happened. And we got the chance to go on a vacation.
Yeah.
And we haven't done that in a very, very, very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to figure out a way to make this a little bit more consistent.
And if anyone has any suggestions is what you like love about our show, what you wish we would, you know, do a little differently. Or if you're looking to hear about something specific or you have an idea, just let us know. All of our contact information is down in the show notes.
Yes.
And that is a long enough detour from the topic that we are giving you today.
Yes.
So, back to our actress.
Ethel Barrymore.
Ethel Barrymore,
yep.
Born on August 15th, definitely today.
Definitely, definitely this upcoming week, yeah. So, I'm sure many of you heard the last name Barrymore and thought, like Drew Barrymore?
Uh-huh, I did when I asked for the title of the episode so I could save it. And I'm like, surely it can't be. So I asked Kylie to clarify.
So the short answer is yes. Ethel Barrymore is actually the great aunt of Drew Barrymore. So they're related.
Very cool.
And both women are part of what was referred to as theater's royal family, at least in America.
Oh, I don't think I was aware of that.
So I'm going to back up a little bit in case you, like Jonathan, were not aware of this.
Beep, beep, beep.
Oh, no. Okay. So Ethel, Lionel, and John Barrymore, who those are her two siblings, could claim an impeccable family tree. Their maternal grandfather's name was John Drew, and he lived from 1827 to 1862. And he was the leading tragedy actor of the 19th century American stage and a beloved Shakespearean actor to boot. Their maternal grandmother, so John Drew's wife, Louisa Lane Drew, who had been an even more formidable presence on the stage than her husband, and who was said to be the only fellow thespian of whom Edwin Booth felt threatened. So Edwin Booth was like the big Shakespearean actor of like the 1800s, and he was also John Wilkes Booth's brother.
Oh!
Yeah.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
What a twist.
I know. So, he was like the biggest Shakespearean actor of the time, and he felt threatened by how good she was. So,
okay.
Considering the fact that she's female and he's male, that's like a really big deal, especially in that time. Anyway, so Louisa would go on to manage Philadelphia's most famous theater in this time called The Arch, and she was known in the theater world as the Duchess, And anyone who had hopes for a future on the stage never got on her bad side. She could, like, completely sink your career if she wanted to.
Why do I feel like I knew that she was called the Duchess? Was this brought up in, like, any sort of more modern media?
I have no idea.
Huh, okay.
The only thing I can think of is the Duchess from the Aristocats.
I probably heard something somewhere about this, and that just sparked a memory.
Well, now I'm suddenly wondering if there's a connection between the owner of all the cats and the Aristocats and her. I'm sure there isn't. I'm sure my brain is just like, here, have this information, and it has no relation whatsoever.
Everybody wants to be a cat.
If I'm wrong and you know, tell me. Anyway. So, John and Louisa Drew's children were on the stage almost as soon as they could talk. Georgiana Drew, their daughter, became the favorite comedian of the discerning Gilded Age audiences. Her brother Sidney was a noted comedian, and her second brother, John Jr., was eventually dubbed the first gentleman of the American stage. And to complete the picture, Georgiana married a dashing young Englishman just making a name for himself in American theater. Herbert Maurice Blythe had been born in India of Anglo-Indian parents who were civil servants during the British Raj. Horrified that their son had plans to become an actor, they allegedly begged him to at least change his name before he took to the stage. So he grabbed the nearest book, put his finger on the first character name that he came to, and then pronounced himself from there on Maurice Barrymore.
There you go. What a way to do it.
I mean, hey, you definitely could have found a worse name.
Uh-huh.
So he arrived in America in 1874, secured his first stage role the following year, and then shortly afterward married Georgiana Drew. The couple had three children, Lionel, who was born April 28th of 1878, Ethel, our star of the story, who was born on August 15th, 1879, and John, born February 15th, 1882. There's a lot of Johns in this. I'm just going to say it now.
Listen, there's a lot of Johns in English language.
Everywhere, yes.
Everywhere.
Yeah, there's one. There's a John in each generation.
Yeah.
So Ethel was actually named after her father's favorite character, Ethel, in William Makepeace Thackeray's The Newcomes. I'm not familiar with that, but apparently that's where she got her name from.
Me neither.
She spent her childhood in Philadelphia with her brothers, where they attended Roman Catholic schools. Their childhood was surprisingly stable, given the fact that their parents were frequently touring. But the children stayed with their maternal grandmother, Louisa, with frequent visits from their uncles on their way to or from engagements, as well as a plethora of house guests from the best society in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, who were brought home for long weekends by their parents.
My goodness.
Yeah. So they knew a lot of people from a very young age, especially within, like, the theater community. Summers were spent at a camp on Staten Island, where 11-year-old Ethel made her acting debut in a homegrown production of Dumas's The Lady of the Camillas with her brothers in the supporting cast. They charged a penny for admission to sit in a barn on the camp property, which they had converted into a theater. And preparing for her death scene, Ethel practiced a tubercular cough to such great effect that a camp supervisor actually feared that she had gotten a bone stuck in her throat.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Like, someone was like, oh, my gosh, are you okay? And she's like, I'm fine. He's like, what? Yeah, exactly. So in 1884, the family sailed to England and stayed there for 2 years. Maurice had inherited a substantial amount of money from an aunt and decided to exhibit and star in some plays in London's Haymarket Theatre. It was during this trip that the Barrymores met Oscar Wilde, and Ethel would later recall being reprimanded by her parents because she was, like, visibly afraid of him when she gave, like, served him some, like, tea cakes. And then they were like, why were you so weird with him? And she's like, I don't know, I'm scared.
He's a very big name, I'm nervous.
And he looks wild.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. That was a bad joke.
I rolled my eyes so hard that I see the waveform in the recording.
Anyway, Ethel would also remember the 2 years that they spent in London as some of the happiest of her childhood, mostly due to the fact that the Barrymores were more of a nuclear family in London than they were in the U.S. because they were actually all, like, living together most of the time. So upon returning to the U.S. in 1886, her father took her to her first baseball game, which established a lifelong love of the sport, and also introduced her to the idea of becoming a concert pianist, which we can tell just from the intro to this that she did not do, but that was kind of like her ambition for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of funny. In the summer of 1893, Barrymore was in the company of her mother, Georgie, who had been ailing from tuberculosis and took a curative sabbatical to Santa Barbara, California. Georgie, unfortunately, didn't recover and died in July of 1893, a week before her 37th birthday.
Yikes.
So she was pretty young, yeah. Essentially, Ethel and Lionel's childhoods ended when Georgie died.
Mm-hmm.
They were forced to go to work in their teens with neither of them finishing high school. John was a few years younger and stayed with their grandmother and other relatives. Ethel's first appearance on Broadway was in 1895 in a play called The Imprudent Young Couple, which starred her uncle, John Drew Jr., and Maud Adams. And she actually later appeared with Drew and Adams again in 1896 in Rosemary. So her uncle pretty much facilitated her entrance into Broadway in a way.
Okay.
In 1897, Ethel went with William Gillette to London to play Miss Kittredge in Gillette's Secret Service. She was about to return to the States when Henry Irving and Ellen Terry offered her the role of Annette in The Bells. The show ran a full tour, and Ethel created the role of Euphrosyne in Peter the Great at the Lyceum, the play having been written by Irving's son, Lawrence. So at this point, men all across both England and the U.S. were getting pretty smitten with Ethel, notably Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
Who asked her to marry him.
Oh!
Yep. She had no desire to be a politician's wife, however, and refused.
Good choices.
Yeah. Years later, Winston married a woman named Clementine Hoser, who actually looks a lot like Ethel.
Oh, boy.
Uh-huh. But Ethel and Winston allegedly remained friends for the rest of her life, like kind acquaintances kind of thing.
Oh, well, that's
good. So, like, no hard feelings, I guess. So after her season in London, Ethel returned to the U.S. where Charles Frohman cast her in several roles, culminating in one that would shoot her to stardom, Madame Trelawney in Captain Jinx of the Horse Marines.
That sounds fun.
That sounds like a really entertaining show, just thinking. It also makes me think of one of those, like, really cheap romance novels that you get at, like, the grocery store.
I can see.
Captain Jinx and the Horse Marines. I don't know why, but that makes me laugh. So this show opened at the Garrick Theater in London's West End on February 4th of 1901. When the tour concluded in Boston in June, she had outdrawn two of the most prominent actresses of the day, Mrs. Patrick Campbell and Minnie Mattern Fisk. Also unbeknownst to Ethel, her father had witnessed the performance as an audience member and walked up to his daughter, congratulated her, and gave her a big hug. It would be the first and only time he would see her on stage professionally.
Whoa.
Later that year, after he had been behaving erratically for a fair amount of time, Maurice was declared legally insane, which was basically the result of having contracted syphilis, like, immediately when he came to New York.
Mm.
That went untreated and basically ravaged everything.
Yeah, it'll do that to you.
Yeah, it's not good. This is your PSA to get checked for any and all STDs.
Yep.
So he was declared legally insane, and unfortunately, he was committed to an asylum. And it was actually Ethel's painful duty to sign those commitment papers to put him there. And he would end up institutionalized for the rest of his life.
Rough.
Yeah. So following the triumph of Captain Jinx, which really, it's really cool that her dad got to see that before things went downhill.
Uh-huh.
Ethel gave sterling performances in many top-rated productions. And it was in Thomas Raceward's Sunday that she uttered what would be her most famous line. That's all there isn't any more. Ethel would use the line after the play to quiet the thunderous applause beckoning her to do a curtain call. The phrase, which basically exemplified her blunt humor and absolute distaste for attention, would become a part of, like, the national language at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really ironic to me that she didn't really like having a ton of attention when she was an actress.
Well, I think that's actually kind of common, and we won't take that weird little turn there, but a lot of actors are introverts.
Yeah, that's true.
You always have to remember that people who are actors, for the most part, were theater kids.
Oh,
theater kids get picked on. It's hard to remember that sometimes because, like, especially very big actors and, you know, the ones you see all the time on film is like, oh, you know, they're very macho. They're very charismatic. They're all these things. And it's like, you have to remember they were the drama kids.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then, I mean, you have actors who, like, are clearly very outgoing and are extroverts, which makes you think that everyone else is like that too, when they probably aren't.
Yeah, they're the minority.
Yeah. Okay. So,
or they've grown into it.
Also fair. Okay, so she used this line in her to avoid doing a curtain call, essentially. She would also parody using this line in a 1949 Christmas broadcast on Bing Crosby's radio show, although she couldn't actually make it through the whole line reading because she kept bursting into laughter.
Yeah.
Her leading roles in A Doll's House by the Norwegian dramatist Henrik Ibsen in 1905 and Alice Sit by the Fire by Scottish dramatist James N. Barry in 1906 established her as one of the foremost actresses in the American theater. Her portrayal of Lady Helen Haddon, a lower-class woman who enters high society by marriage only to be destroyed by it, in Zoe Atkins' Déclassée was another of her successes in the early 1900s. And it prompted the then-fledgling theater critic for Vanity Fair, Dorothy Parker, which if anyone has followed like historical theater critic stuff, Dorothy Parker's a huge name.
Okay.
To state precociously, quote, if during my theater-going lifetime there has been one other performance so perfect as the one Ethel Barrymore gives, I can only say I had the hideous misfortune to miss it.
Oh.
Basically saying, I've never seen anything as good as this, yeah. And I don't think there is anything. So that's really neat. Another admirer was named Russell Colt, the son of a millionaire inventor who was a frequent backstage visitor and escort. In 1909, Ethel married him.
Oh.
And they set up a house at the sprawling estate near Mamaroneck, New York, given to them as a wedding present by Russell's father. While Russell commuted to Wall Street every morning, Ethel retired from the stage to give birth to three children between 1910 and 1913. Samuel, Ethel Barrymore Colt, and John.
And John.
Like I said, there's one in every generation. However, by the end of the decade, it would become pretty apparent that Russell's interests lay more with other women than with providing for his family.
Uh-oh. Mm.
In 1911, Ethel allegedly actually filed for divorce, but later recanted this as a misunderstanding by the press. So it's kind of unclear whether or not she did, in fact, start to make overtures for a divorce at that early, or if it was something that like the press thought they heard and like ran with.
Yeah.
There's also at least one source that alleged Colt abused her and that he had fathered a child with another woman while they were still married. They divorced in 1923, but on a cordial basis. And according to her memoirs, they would sometimes still have supper together even after like it having been divorced for ages. Ethel never remarried, and her daughter would actually claim that her mother's existence after the divorce was almost nun-like. Ethel once told a close friend, quote, it's not the church affiliation that prevents me from marrying again. The plain truth of the matter is that I've never met a man I would want to be married to. Which is fair. In 1914, Ethel made her film debut in The Nightingale. She and her brothers recognized the potential of this new medium film, although Ethel never quite took easily to the screen. She appeared in films in New York and Hollywood through 1919, but she never cared for Hollywood or for working in films, so she ended up returning to New York City and the stage. In 1919, Ethel and her brothers had high-profile roles in the Actors' Equity Association strike against the unfair practices of theater owners and managers. And this feels very timely, considering SAG-AFTRA is on strike right now and the Writers Guild and everything. Yep. So I'm like, hey, yeah.
Yeah, timely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, love it. Hot strike summer. Woo. Hot strike summer.
That reminds me, another podcast that I listen to has called this summer a hog girl summer for some reason. I don't know.
What?
We don't have time to explore that right now, but it's funny. Anyway, that you saying that reminded me of it. So appearing at benefit performances and public rallies, the Barrymores were instrumental in the success of the strike, which actually forced theater managers and agents to recognize the unionization of the profession under actors' equity. Originally started in 1896, the first actors' union charter was recognized by the American Federation of Labor as an attempt to create a minimum wage for actors being exploited, which is pretty important.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, in January 1913, the union charter failed. But actors seeking fair wages and treatment didn't let that stop them. And several influential actors, known as the Players, which is why I went with the player quote from earlier.
Ah, there you go. Full circle.
Held secret organizational meetings at Edwin Booth's The Players, which was a private social club, at his Gramercy Park mansion. In the meeting held on May 26, 1913, at the Pabst Grand Circle Hotel in New York City, which I think is still there, Actors' Equity was founded by 112 professional theater actors who established its constitution and elected Francis Wilson as president. Actors' Equity joined the American Federation of Labor in 1919 and called a strike seeking recognition as a labor union. The strike ended the dominance of the Producing Managers Association, including theater owners and producers like Abe Erlinger and his partner Mark Claw, who were big on the exploitation end of things. The strike increased membership from under 3,000 to approximately 14,000 actors.
Nice.
I know. Additionally, the Chorus Equity Association, which would merge with Actors Equity in 1955, was founded during the strike as well. So Ethel was highly involved in this Actors Equity strike, and it may have been in part motivated by the fate of both of her parents, who were both longstanding actors. Her mother had needed better medical care when she had tuberculosis, and her father had required years of institutionalized care. So her support for the strike probably stemmed from a lot of that, because they weren't able to do those things.
Also, if he had medical care, he may not have gone insane.
Bingo. So her support of the strike angered many of her like producer friends and stuff, and actually cost her some friendships with pretty influential producers like George M. Cohen, who was an actor, songwriter, and producer.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens on strikes is if when you strike, people lose money.
Yep.
And if not everyone's on board, they're going to be very bitter about the fact that you just cost them money.
Yep. And it's very, very easy to see who cares about other people and who doesn't.
So, incredibly obvious.
After the strike, Ethel continued to find great success on the stage. In 1926, she scored one of her greatest successes as the sophisticated spouse of a philandering husband in W. Somerset Maugham's comedy, The Constant Wife. And Maugham actually counted himself among her many admirers, saying that during rehearsals for the play, he had, quote, fallen madly in love with her, which I just thought was really funny.
I also find it funny that the part that she's playing is essentially just her life.
Yeah.
At least from that brief description there.
Yep. I mean, it's at least her personal life was like that. So
vulnerability sells.
Yep.
Honest acting is good acting.
Yep. So during the 1920s and 30s, she only made one film, Rasputin and the Empress, in 1933, which was the sole work in which she appeared with both of her brothers. And apparently Ethel had a difficult time adapting to the changes that had happened in film since her film in like 1919, especially the introduction of the microphone.
Yep.
At the end of this of a scene in which Ethel admitted she had been moaning, flailing her arms and touching curtains all over the set, Lionel approached her and goes, "Ethel, what the hell are you doing?" And she replied, "I haven't the faintest idea." At which point, the Barrymore professionalism came to the fore as Lionel and John both gave her some lessons in how to moderate her voice for the microphone. All went well from then on, even though Ethel insisted on so many retakes during the shoot that instead of Empress of the Russians, the crew called her the Empress of the Rushes. In 1944, Clifford Odets convinced her to play an impoverished Cockney mother opposite Cary Grant in the film None But the Lonely Heart. For that performance, she effectively toned down her acting style and received an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
Wow, nice.
Yeah. She again gave a compassionate performance in The Spiral Staircase in 1946 and finally seemed comfortable making movies. In her later films, she was pretty typically cast as the imperious but lovable matriarch of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So think like Maggie Smith. You don't watch Downton Abbey. Never mind.
I don't watch Downton Abbey. You can say that for the listener.
For the listeners, think Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey.
Also, that is unfortunately just the career path for actresses. Oh, you're over 40? Welcome to the mother role.
Yeah.
You're very old. Maybe even a grandmother.
Yes. We're not going to go into that.
Yeah.
So Ethel continued working until heart disease forced her to slow down and eventually retire in 1958. Through it all, she managed to raise her three children to adulthood. Quote, "the most important thing in my life," she would say. Often asked what kind of mother Ethel Barrymore had been, Ethel Barrymore Colt once replied, quote, "her relations with us were extraordinary in spite of the fact that we were put under the care of governesses and were sent to boarding schools because she was away a good deal of the time. We would see her after babyhood at the Ritz in Boston, in Chicago at Christmas, Atlantic City in Easter. We weren't overmothered by any means. She was a goddess to us. She was wonderful and warm, but let's face it, she didn't change our pants." So all three children would dabble in theater and film. Samuel Colt became a Hollywood agent and occasional actor. Ethel became an actress and singer, appearing on Broadway in Stephen Sondheim's Follies. And John Drew Colt also became an actor. Ethel outlived both of her brothers, unfortunately. John died in 1942 and Lionel in 1954. Ethel Barrymore died of cardiovascular disease on June 18th, 1959, at her home in Hollywood, less than 2 months shy of her 80th birthday. That night at the Ethel Barrymore Theater in New York City, the audience was informed that the curtain for Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun would go up late. At 8 p.m., the house lights dimmed to half for 5 minutes in silent tribute to the woman for whom the theater had been built and named 31 years before. She was entombed at Calvary Cemetery, and in 1960, Ethel Barrymore was posthumously inducted into the Hollywood Walk of Fame with a motion picture star for her contributions to the film industry. Her star is located at 7001 Hollywood Boulevard, for anyone who wants to go find it, and she was also a member of the American Theater Hall of Fame. And that is the life of the fabulous Ethel Barrymore, great aunt to Drew Barrymore, and last of the American theater's royal family.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I have fun with that one.
Also, was Drew Barrymore just named after the two last names of her ancestors?
Yes.
Or maybe she picked that because actors tend to pick their names if they have something. Did Drew Barrymore pick her own name?
You know what I bet would probably be able to tell us pretty easily?
Google.
Google, baby. Drew Barrymore. American actress. Born Drew Blythe Barrymore.
So three.
All three last names.
All three last names of her ancestors.
I love it. Oh my gosh.
Wild.
Yep. All three last names of her ancestors. Perfect.
Huh. I guess that's one way to do it.
Yup.
Okay, so we have some fun facts for you, but before we get there, we're going to do our call to action real quick. Mm-hmm. With social media in turmoil, as we maybe mentioned at least a few episodes.
Probably.
We're going to stop mentioning that now. We're just going to transition fully into, look at our show notes. We have, the episode description.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of links there to all of our stuff, how you can contact us. It'll be updated regardless of what happens. The most important one is go to halfwitpodcast.com. That's where we put everything that we work on. Right now it's two things. There is a third thing that's a little bit of a puzzle if there's some puzzly people out there that want to see.
If you like solving mysteries, take a look.
Yeah, and hopefully that number climbs. It's a lot of work, but we're loving doing it. So we'll see what else we make in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fun facts.
Fun fact. Oh, wait, woo-hoo. No, we didn't thank the fishermen for the use of our theme song, Another Day. You can find a link to their SoundCloud down in our show notes.
Yes.
Now we can do fun facts.
Ho-ho.
So, let's go to... Well, since we're going to be talking about Japan in our next episode, we will do the fun fact for August 14th of 1281. That's an old day. You can tell that I don't say old days very, very often.
Had to think really hard about that order of numbers, didn't you?
During Kublai Khan.
Kublai Khan.
That's how you say Kublai? It has an I in it?
I'm pretty sure.
You're right. That is Kublai Khan.
Yeah.
During Kublai Khan's second Mongol invasion of Japan, his invading Chinese fleet of 3,500 vessels disappears in a typhoon.
Womp womp.
Oops, you tried.
I find it really funny that it took you so long to decide on that one when I opened my notes and went, oh, he's going to pick the one about Japan.
Well, I got to read them all.
Fair enough.
So what's your fun fact?
My fun fact is going to be on August 20th of 1998. Not very long ago. The Supreme Court of Canada rules that Quebec cannot legally secede from Canada without the federal government's approval.
That seems odd. I think if a huge chunk of land wants to say they're not involved in a government anymore, I don't think the government should really get a say as to whether that's true.
You know what? I smell a revolution. I don't know.
I don't know.
It was...
We're all about revolution.
A while ago, so maybe not yet.
Hot union summers.
Hot revolution summer.
In general, we're a punch-up family.
Yeah.
Anyways, thank you all for listening. Hear us next time talk about our trip to Japan.
Woo-hoo!
And we're going to make sure we have some... It's kind of going to be fun fact-filled. We're not going to dive too deep into anything.
Yeah. a plethora of fun facts with slightly more information than usual.
Yeah, fun factorama we're going to be doing centered around Japan.
Woohoo!
So, as always, I've been your halfwit.
And I'm your historian.
And we hope you listen next time.
Bye.